We were talking about the critics of Billy Graham. The most blistering critic of Billy Graham was our old friend Reinhold Niebuhr from the neo-Orthodox world of the 1930s and 40s. Reinhold Niebuhr preached sermon after sermon personally about Billy Graham and his gospel. He especially was concerned that Billy Graham seemed to equate sin with behavior, the way you act, with things like drinking, smoking, as it was called back then, cussing, dancing, playing cards, and going to their own kinds of movies. This was, in this emphasis on social and moral behavior, he said, Billy Graham overlooked the truly dark side of the human condition as it was reflected not in individual acts, but in the acts of society. Social sins, racism, bigotry, war, political corruption, ignoring and exploiting the poor, the weak, and the helpless. All those things that Jesus really talked a lot about. In 1949, Reinhold Niebuhr's younger brother, H. Richard Niebuhr, gave a series of lectures in the small Texas town called Austin at Austin Presbyterian Theological Seminary. He taught theological ethics at Yale, and he gave a series of lectures which were published in 1951 in a wonderful and important book called Christ and Culture. 1951, H. Richard Niebuhr, Christ and Culture. In it, Richard Niebuhr talked about the variety of ways in which Christians over the years have responded to the relationship between Christ and culture, Jesus and society. They ranged from very conservative people who said that there should be no relationship, that the social gospel has no, that the gospel of Jesus has no social implications, to those liberals who say that they do and that they're most important. This is a very learned book. It is serious going. It's hard to read. It is an analysis of the ways in which 2,000 years of Christians have understood the relationship between their Christian beliefs and the responsibilities that they have to culture and society. If for no other reason, the fact that this is such an intellectual achievement of the life of the mind, was a stunning rebuke of the mindless, as far as they were concerned, gospel of Billy Graham and his crusades. But, and this is Dr. Miller's point, young people, the man who wrote this was no brain-dead liberal. He had as dark an understanding of the fallen condition of mankind as Billy Graham did. But both H. Richard Niebuhr and his brother understood that sin comes in two varieties: individual sin and corporate social sin. That evil exists in the institutions of society as thoroughly as it does in the hearts of fallen men and women. And in the 1950s, these two men, who had made their reputations in the 30s and 40s in the emergence of neo-orthodoxy, delivered a devastating critique of the intellectual vacuity of Billy Graham and his crusades. And that's the only point I want to make about that. All righty? Last year, or maybe the first time I taught Jesus, I had kids read Christ and Culture. And I learned my lesson. Life is too short. Okay. Let's talk now about the marketplace and sentimentality. The 50s have also been called the age of sentimentality. Sentiment, excessive emotion, emphasis on emotion and feeling rather than reason or thought. The age of sentimentality was perhaps most evident in the marketplace, especially in popular music. We have already heard I Believe. We have just heard Crying in the Chapel. There was a wonderful song called He. He can touch a leaf and turn, he can touch a tree and turn the leaves to gold. He knows every lie that you and I have told. Though it makes him sad to know the way, see the way we live, he'll always say, I forgive. He, in the 50s, everyone knew what who he was. There was one called, Have You Talked to the Man Upstairs? Have you talked to the man upstairs? He will see you through. Rosemary Clooney. You don't have any idea. Here in these songs, pop singers began to collapse the distance between sinners and God. Sinners and Jesus. The distance between Christians and Jesus begins to be very, very evident. It was most obvious in a quote from one of the movie stars of the time. Does the name Jane Russell mean anything to anyone in this room? She's very old now, and she made her living for a while advertising brassieres. Anyhow, in the 50s, she was a really hot number. And she said of Jesus in 1952 in an interview that Jesus was a living doll. You can see the look on your faces. No distance at all. Jesus is a living God. Sentiment. I'm sorry. A doll. Jesus, well, he's a living God too. What you believe? Okay. Sentiment was one of the ways to calm the anxieties of the period. Sentimentality. As an answer to anxiety. And that will lead me then to the peace of mind movement of the 1950s. Peace of mind was one of the most frequently heard phrases of the 1950s. There were not one, two, three, but four best-selling books called either Peace of Mind, Peace of Soul, Peace with God, Peace with Yourself, on and on and on. Peace. Calm those anxieties of this age of anxiety. This sentimentality often went with an inability or unwillingness to engage with the dark side of human nature and the human condition. And it was a period in which we saw a rebirth of the positive thinking movement of the late 19th century and the early 20th century, back to Mary Baker Eddy and Christian Science. This is associated with a man named Norman Vincent Peale, a Dutch Reformed Calvinist minister, who in 1952 wrote the best-selling book of the 1950s, The Power of Positive Thinking. It was on the bestseller list for most of the years of the first half of the 1950s. Here he puts positive thinking in the terms of a gospel for the way one lives one life. All of the problems of life, and young people, I mean all of them, can be cured with positive thinking. The mind controls everything. Let's look at the table of contents of this book. First of all, believe in yourself because a peaceful mind generates power. How are you going to have constant power? Try prayer power. How are you going to create your own happiness? Stop fuming and fretting. Expect the best and get it. Don't believe in defeat. Stop worrying. And then you'll have the power to solve personal problems. Name a personal problem. Got sick. How about using your faith to heal? But what if you have a slump? When vitality sags, try this health formula. And here he told you how to do positive thinking. Have an inflow of new thought. It can remake you. But what if it gets really bad and your heart breaks? Here's what you do. You draw upon a higher power. This is sort of the biggest all-time bestseller how-to self-help book. Folks, have you ever looked? Do you regularly shop the self-help how-to books at B&N? Well, this is one of the biggies of that tradition. Now, there is virtually no theological content in this book until that last chapter. And then it's not on Jesus. It's on God. And the power that comes through the third member of the Trinity, the Holy Spirit. Jesus pays little, if almost no sense of this at all. Yes. Was he criticized for making God the last resort? Well, God is the last resort. You know, most people would have thought that was just exactly right, right? And finally, you just get over yourself and realize that he's God and you're not. That's actually good Christian stuff, right? Okay. But now, was he criticized for being absolutely, totally brain dead? Yes. Lots of it. Folks, this is fascinating because positive thinking leads to mental health, great relationships, more hair, and even financial success. Folks, don't you, as early 21st century Americans, laugh at this idea. There's a whole contingent of Christianity now who is preaching exactly this. If you believe right, what's going to happen to you? You're going to prosper, just like Jesus said. Believe in men, you'll get richer increases. What gospel is that in? Mark, Luke, doesn't sound much like Jesus, but it's here now, okay? Shut up, Miller. Now, your mamas and daddies were born here, right? How many of your mothers and daddies were born in the early 1950s? Okay. Now, a lot of your grandpas and grandmas were heathens. You know, maybe they were believers and maybe they weren't. They didn't go to church a whole lot. But then they had your mama. And guess what they had to do? They had to raise your mama right. So all of a sudden, they had to find some place to take these kids to church. And here they came. The boomers created the great church boom of the 1950s. $1 billion worth of construction. $1 billion of their money. Back, folks, that's an enormous amount of money. And everyone started to go to Sunday school. And all of a sudden, we had a new Jesus. Sunday school Jesus. Now, I'm not sure that what's queued up here, so you'll forgive me. Oh, I didn't tell you about mustard seed. This is parenthetical. One of Norman Vincent Peale's parishioners was at his church in New York City, was an inventor. And he wasn't doing positive thinking very well. But he and his wife went to church one day and heard Dr. Peale preach on the parable of the mustard seed. And they got all invigorated. And over Sunday lunch, they thought about making jewelry. Now, have you ever heard of mustard seed jewelry? You ever heard of mustard seed jewelry? Okay, now this isn't Jesus in art, but this is Jesus' teaching in art, isn't it? And all of a sudden, these were everywhere. And they are so collectible now. Here little rings. These are really tacky. Really, can you see? Well, here, a little mustard seed or something like it being mustard. You know the parable of mustard seed? It grows into a big, actually, did you know it doesn't? There's no such thing as a mustard tree. I mean, it's about like this. I mean, it's really weird. Jesus was off day. Here we go. Kind of plastic. And all of a sudden, all the girls had on these hula hoops and hula hoop skirts and all that kind of stuff and poodle dogs on them and petticoats for days. And everyone wore mustard seed. Here's one. It's original box. wonderful? Okay. End of parenthetical memory lapse. We move on. Solomon, from the head of Christ, had all kinds of paintings in the 1950s. Study to show thyself approved. Here's Jesus helping out with homework. Isn't that cute? This is a fascinating Christ our pilot. Do you see anything? Can you read this? Look at it. Can you read this? Can you see anything in this? Obviously, Christ is guiding this young man. Can you see anything? Look very carefully. What about the cloud? A what? Kendall, what does it look like? A lion. See? Solomon said, that's not a lion, that's a cloud. But people would have, that's a lion. All righty? Ready to stay. Jesus is taking care of it. Can you see that this is Jesus, the iconic Jesus, full view? Teach me thy way. He careth for you. Remember, didn't he talk about this? Kind of ignoring the little girl. Actually, this is kind of blessed out Jesus, isn't it? I think it's a very weird looking Jesus, actually. Let's go to church. 1947. Okay. And one of my old-time friends, former student, was born in 1949. And last year for Christmas, she said, I'm going to give you something that I made in 1956 in Sunday school in her Church of Christ in Dallas. And if you want it, you can have it. Folks, this is Sunday School Jesus for real. This was made in 1956 by Carol McDonald. I wish you could see it because all of those little Jewish disciples have the bluest eyes in the world. But isn't this wonderful? And she painted it. And but the back, it's signed Carol. Aww. Boomers at work. She now makes $300,000. Go to Sunday school. Okay. Questions? Yes. Sunday school, Jesus, just another version of domestic, female, nurturing Jesus that drove you-know-who crazy. Who? Bruce Barton. Is there anything new to what's going? Is that it's all over the place now, Stephanie. Sunday school, Jesus now begins to be iconic because all the boomers are going to Sunday school. All right, we need now to turn to the 50 cinematic lives of Jesus. And because we are really behind, I don't know how much of our films we're going to get to see in the next 2 weeks, but I'll do the best I can. Hollywood needed to do two things in the 1950s. It needed to find an answer to the small screen of television that was rapidly cutting into its audiences. Hollywood also needed to demonstrate its patriotism. In the Red Scare, Congress was focusing on Hollywood in the hunt for communists and for homosexuals and other subversives. So, back in the 1950s, they thought biblical spectacles are a safe bet. And the decade is awash in films about the Bible. The first blockbuster was, the first really huge one, was the 1956 blockbuster, The Ten Commandments, starring Charlton Heston, of course, as Moses. Have you ever seen a theatrical production or version of Ten Commandments? You see it on television. Have you seen The Ten Commandments? All righty. In the theatrical version, in 1956, the film opens with DeMille. Remember in the Silent, the King of Kings, DeMille states that sort of evangelical, Jesus told us to preach the gospel, and here it is. It's an evangelical statement. He can't get away with that in the 1950s. It's still the same Cecil B. DeMille, right? But he comes out, there's this red curtain, it parts, And there is, by God, Cecil B. DeMille talking to you. And he gives a little sermon about liberty and democracy. Cold War, remember? He steps behind the curtain and directly addresses the audience about the study of Moses, the story of Moses, being a story of the triumph of freedom over the forces of tyranny. The first century films that we see in the 1950s had to deal with another form of tyranny, not Egyptian tyranny, but who's the tyrant in these films, first century films? Come on. Rome, the Roman Empire. The view of Rome and the Roman Empire in these films is a complicated one. The U.S. is just beginning to emerge as the most powerful nation in the world. And it now has an empire of its own. And these 50 films offer deal with the complexities of the responsibilities of empire. Now, the first one of these was published, was made in 1953, and it is The Robe. Has anyone ever seen The Robe? Ready, Kendall? It was based on a 1942 best-selling novel by a man named Lloyd C. Douglas, who was one of the best-selling novelists of the 30s, 40s, and 50s. The Robe is one of the many novels in the 30s and 40s written about Jesus and the first century Christians. It is the story of a Roman centurion. It is the story of the Roman centurion who wins Jesus' robe gambling at the foot of the cross. This man is the son of a very important Roman senator. And back in Rome, this man, whose name is Marcellus, M-A-R-C-E-L-L-U-S, if you want. Back in Rome, this young man, at the beginning of the movie, gets in trouble with the young prince, the heir apparent to Tiberius' throne, Caligula. He makes the prince angry, and he sends him to Judea to punish him. And the segment that we're going to start watching today, we see Marcellus enter Jerusalem with his slave, Demetrius. A slave played by a man named Victor Mature. Victor Mature. The buxom Jane Russell made one film with Victor Mature, same one I told you a while ago with Jesus is a Living Doll. She made one film with Victor Mature, and she said she would never do that again, but she never wanted again to make a movie with a man whose breasts were bigger than hers. You'll see it in a minute. As the movie begins, or as what we're going to see begins, we see Marcellus and Demetrius enter Jerusalem. Guess what day it is? Palm Sunday. Jesus rides by as he enters the city, and he looks into Demetrius' eyes. And that look begins the conversion experience of the young man. Demetrius understands that this man is important and that he is going to be, that he's going to finally get into trouble. So when he does get arrested, he tries to get Marcellus to intercede for Jesus. And then he tries to find the disciples to warn them about it. And we're going to see the scene in which he finds one of the disciples, a man who looks very troubled, and he is Judas, after he has already betrayed Jesus. So we're going to see that. Then we're going to cut to the crucifixion as we see what happens when Marcellus wins the robe, and then when it starts raining, as he puts on the robe, guess what it does to him? No, it doesn't convert him. It drives him mad. It drives him mad. He is so mad, I don't mean angry, I mean mad, that he is sent back to Rome, where the kind emperor decides with the help of his soothsayers that what he must do in order to exorcise the spell that was in the robe, what must he do? Come on, what must he do? If you have been bewitched by a piece of cloth, what must you do? Find it first, Frank. You have to find it and then destroy it. So he sets off for Palestine. And he, in fact, finds Demetrius and a set of Christians headed by the big one, Peter. All righty? And Demetrius leads him to embrace the robe. And when he finally touches the robe, then it begins the conversion experience. And he becomes one of them. Marcellus saves the Christians from being massacred by Roman soldiers that he once commanded. And then he and Peter engage in kind of a mutual confession of their betrayal of Jesus. You think you're bad for killing him? I betrayed him, not once, but three times. And then they let Marcellus join their Christian group. And they all wind up in Rome, where Marcellus is martyred at the hands of the mad emperor. This is not a movie about Jesus. This is a movie about Jesus's effect on and impact on people's lives. All righty? Yes. Yes. The question is about the power of his, just looking at him. Folks, this isn't just from the not 20th century, is it? Where does Ben-Hur's conversion begin? It's just the power of looking at Jesus. The effect of the man himself. The effect of the man himself has nothing to do with sentimentality. Frank? Probably not. It's part of incarnational theology. Folks, if you really believe in incarnational theology, this is the Son of God walking around. Something's got to seep out. And it did. Yes. Why is there a 30-year break? Thank you very much. I believe that it is simply because the silent King of Kings seemed to have done it all. And the movies, can anyone else think of a reason why for 30 years we didn't have a life of Jesus? Why do we have one in the 50s? I just told you. Sound? Were people out there demanding lives of Jesus? No. Safe topic, the television. Folks, you have no idea. In the 1950s, Americans averaged going to the movies three times a week. And that little tube then came in. And all of a sudden, they collapsed. The Supreme Court declared the studio system that owned all the movie theaters, declared it unconstitutional. And all of a sudden, Hollywood, the studio system, was in big trouble. They turned to Jesus. Just as they had back in the 1920s. These were safe films. Actually, the Robe is actually a very effective movie. It's kind of sentimental. But man, I can feel this effect on you folks. It's had some effect, right? This is realistic. You know, there's all that gap in the silent films because it's just so weird. It's just so weird to us. This is not weird.